Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 14th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Ruth, God's Faith Puts Frightened Feet on Familiar Ground. Presented by Hans Dahl. Session number DAH 2005-02. Let's listen in.
With you. And also with you.
Let us pray. God of grace, God of peace, and God of the morning, we give thanks for this day, for the beautiful views of the mountains and the forests all around us, and for the people here that you've created, for the people as we gather here to open your word, that your word might be revealed to us in new and unusual ways this day. We give thanks for all this in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Well, yesterday we started with the Exodus story, but the story of Moses, his calling, the burning bush story there. And it's a theophany story. It's the story of God being present in just kind of an unusual way. I mean, this burning of the bush it's not something we see every day. There aren't these bushes burning around us, and so it's an unusual, it's called a theophany, I guess that would be the theological word for it. And so we started talking about how God says to Moses in this experience, take off your shoes. That's, you see shoes, we got here and someone said, what the heck are these shoes all about?
Now I realize it's take off your shoes.
So that's been the theme around here, I guess, for the summer. Take it from these verses here in Exodus, the beginning of Exodus. And so it's a theophany experience. It's an experience where what I believe God is saying to Moses here is, I desire intimacy with you. You know, this idea of taking off your shoes, of connecting with the earth. We talked yesterday a little bit. Larry spoke about how the earth, the word for take off your shoes, you're standing on the ground, on holy ground. There's a play on words there with Adam, which is also the word for human. And so connect with that which is your very being, the ground of your being, from where you came. And so there's this whole play with intimacy here, I think, that's being driven towards. There's this idea of Moses, just relax. You know, you're standing on holy ground, just relax and enjoy this intimacy. And there's this sense that when God shows up, things are transformed by God's presence. That God is one who brings promises. Hey, Heidi. One who goes with us, one who guards fugitives like Jacob, one who keeps outsiders like Joseph, one who gives birth in the midst of barrenness. And so in the midst of all that, we turn then to Ruth. And so I invite you to turn to Ruth today. We're going to dig into that some more. And there was a quote from a book that I read here recently. I thought I would read. It's a little bit longer quote, but I think it speaks to us. Has anyone heard of the book The Lexus and the Olive Tree? Yeah, Thomas Friedman wrote this book, and he uses the Lexus and the Olive Tree to talk about kind of our world today, that there are Lexus, the car, you've heard of the car, the Lexus, kind of being the symbol for globalization,
yes.
This move to that kind of washes us of some of our unique cultural characteristics. And so he talks about that, he uses the Lexus. But the other one he uses is the Olive Tree, and that being the more personal things to us, those things that we hold true to, we hold fast. And so I'm just going to read a little portion of that because it connects with, you'll see by the end where it connects here. Olive trees are important. They represent everything that roots us, that anchors us, identifies us, and locates us in this world, whether it be belonging to a family, a community, a tribe, a nation, a religion, or most of all, a place called home. Olive trees are what give us the warmth of family, The joy of individuality, the intimacy of personal rituals, the depth of private relationships, as well as the confidence and security to reach out and encounter others. So he's talking about these things that we hold true, we hold strong to, our roots in our life. We fight so intensely at times over our olive trees, because at their best they provide the feelings of self-esteem and belonging that are as essential for human survival as food in the belly. Indeed, one reason that the nation-state will never disappear, even if it does weaken, is because it is the ultimate olive tree, the ultimate expression of who we belong to linguistically, geographically, and historically. You cannot be a complete person alone. You can be a rich person alone. You can be a smart person alone, but you cannot be a complete person alone. Then he tells this story that he tells. There were people who were a village that was afflicted with a strange plague of forgetfulness, a kind of contagious amnesia, starting with the oldest inhabitants and working its way through the population. The plague caused people to forget the names of even the most common everyday objects. One young man, still unaffected, tries to limit the damage by putting labels on everything. This is a table. This is a window. This is a cow. It has to be milked every day. And at the entrance of the town, on the main road, he puts up two large signs. One reads, "The name of our village is Macondo." And the larger one reads, "God exists." The message I get from this story is that we can and probably will forget most of what we have learned in life. The math, the history, the chemical formulas, the address and phone number of the first house we lived in when we got married. And all that forgetting will do us no harm. But if we forget whom we belong to, and if we forget that there is a God, something profoundly human in us will be lost. He goes on to talk about some of the olive trees and some of the conflicts that have been caused over fights over these olive trees, conflicts between Serbs and Muslims, Jews and Palestinians, over who owns which olive tree seem to be, they are about who will be at home and anchored in a local world and who will not be. Their underlying logic is, I must control this olive tree, because if the other controls it, not only will I be economically and politically under his thumb, but my whole sense of home will be lost. I'll never be able to take my shoes off and relax. Few things are more enraging to people than to have their identity or sense of home stripped away. They will die for it, kill for it, sing for it, write poetry for it, novelize it. Because without a sense of home and belonging, life becomes barren and rootless. And life as a tumbleweed is no life at all. I thought that was interesting that he put that line in there. I'll never be able to take my shoes off and relax. I think about this in the sense of our story about Ruth that we started digging into yesterday. Ruth is this woman with no home. You know, she has no home, but she's pledging her loyalty to Naomi. And so in the midst of kind of this story here, let's plug away here in our story. Now, someone had asked if I would write down the names. Something important in the book of Ruth is the names. The Hebrew literature here is absolutely beautiful. The names at the beginning, if you look in the first chapter, the introduction to our story, we read through this yesterday, but I'll just read through the first five verses again so we get kind of the setting. There are some new people here today. In the days when the judges ruled, we talked about the time of the judges being this time of chaos. It was a time where there was no central government, but rather people did as they willed. You know, they all. If you turn back to the last chapter of Judges, the very last verse, we looked at that yesterday. It reads, "In those days there was no king of Israel. All the people did what was right in their own eyes. And so it was this time of violence. It was a time of chaos. And so in the midst of that, there was a famine in the land, which forced people to move in ancient times. And a certain man of Bethlehem, I forgot to point this out, Bethlehem, I'm trying to remember what the Hebrew is. It is the house of bread or the house of food. And so there's a little bit of irony here in this, that they're moving away from the house of food, the house of bread, to find food, to find a meal. And so there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab. He and his wife and two sons, and the names of the man was Elimelech. I'll just write these on my board so you can. Now, Elimelech, one of the beautiful things in the Hebrew here is that each of these names has meaning. So, does anyone remember what Elimelech was? Elimelech is my God is king.
All
right, very good. No, I wrote it down. You don't have to admit that.
She's very honest.
That's why she acts as
the
church secretary quite a lot.
Writes everything down.
She's good at writing things down.
So right away in this story, we have a sense that this family is grounded. They're grounded in a God, the God of history, the God of creation. So my God is king. And then we've got the other names that will come next. And I'll just write all these down. Naomi. Does anyone remember that one?
Sweetness.
Or pleasantness. Pleasant. Is that right? Yes. And then there are the two sons. Anyone remember those?
I can't see it.
Can you read any of that at all?
The bottom line's getting worse.
Okay. Maybe I'll put a different marker. Does anyone remember the names of those two from yesterday? Last time I was reading this, one of the little ladies who was reading it said, "What about that Oprah person?"
Back of the neck, wasn't it?
Yeah, good. Yes. Oh, gosh. So we got Oprah.
Now you're gonna mix us up.
She was supposed to be named. I think her parents didn't know how to. Named Orpah.
Yeah, and her mother didn't know how to spell. But she spelled wrong.
I'm sure that's it. Yeah. So the last one, Ruth.
Friend,
right. Friend or companion? Can you read any of that? I suppose.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's kind of.
There's a glare on it from that window.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You're telling me.
All right. So we've got all these names. And this is one of the beautiful things of this story, is that the Hebrew is just, when they would have read it originally, there would have been all these foreshadows to what's to come. You know, it's a beautiful literary book. And you'll notice that the story begins in Bethlehem, and the end of this chapter will end in Bethlehem, is where there are these little bookends that really make kind of these neat chapters almost to the story. So it begins and ends in Bethlehem. And where did we end up yesterday? Does anyone remember exactly where we ended up? I might just kind of, for those...
With Ruth's song.
Yeah, with Ruth's song? 21.
Okay. Yeah, because we didn't get to Naomi's song.
Oh, that's right. Okay. So let me see here. So what I'll do is I'll just kind of pick out some highlights here. So we've got the situation. The first five verses really set up this story, and it really is kind of a depressing introduction. You know, it's like, okay, all the kids, the sons have died, husbands died, and here we are in a foreign land, and we're just in a desperate situation here. But then we find out in verse 6, well, let's just read there in verse 6. Then she started to return with her daughters-in-law from the country of Moab. So they're going back because they've heard that there's food here in Bethlehem. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had considered his people and given them food. Now, as the story begins in Bethlehem, it's going to end in Bethlehem as well. But one of the other interesting things in this story is where we see the direct interaction of God with God's people. There are only actually two instances where we hear the narrator talking about God directly interacting in the lives of the people. And this is one of them. In the first little five verses, first paragraph there, there are two situations or two sources of pain that are already brought up. The first is food. How will they survive? Where will they receive their next meal? And the second one is a little more complicated. It's this idea of the family. How will the family continue? How will the family name? There are no men left in the family, and so unfortunately in this society, the family name, how does that family name continue? And so we find out right away, God answers. God is the one of promises, and God provides food. And so we have in verse 6 that the Lord had considered his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she had been living, she and her two daughters-in-law, and they went on their way to go back to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me." In the Hebrew here, the dealt kindly is a special word. The word is hesed, that's the root of the word. And the story we're going to find out is a story of loyalty. It's a story of loyalty. And this word, to deal kindly with, has kind of a rich, deep, deep meaning of loyalty. It's loyalty that happens within the context of a long-term relationship, a relationship that's been going on and will continue. And this is a special kind of loyalty. And we'll find this word will come back later, so I just wanted to point it out. So may the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find security. Again, security for number one, a woman without a male figure in her life. Security is what she was looking for. It's what she would need to survive. And so we get kind of at the beginning of this story, the setting for the story, that the desire, the need is for security. And so we've kind of read through this yesterday, and so I want to skip on ahead to Ruth's song. So now Ruth has decided that she is going to stay. And she, there's no question in her mind that she is going to stay. And so in verse 16, we have Ruth's beautiful song that we'll go through here. I'm just going to find that place. But Ruth said, and can we have a female read that again, as we had yesterday? Beginning at verse 16, that little song there, 16 and 17. Great.
But Ruth said, "Do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There will I be buried. May the Lord do this and so to me, and more as well, even if death parts me from you."
So Ruth here is making specific commitments of loyalty, this idea of hesed, this deep, deep loyalty. She's committing to Naomi's homeland. She's moving from Moab to Bethlehem. She's committing to a homeland, to Naomi's people, to a people who would have persecuted Moabites. She would have been seen as an outsider. And commitment to a different religion, I mean, that's a big step, a big step. And so Ruth really here, we have this picture of a woman going beyond expectations. She goes beyond expectations in that it would have been natural for her to say, as Orpah did, or Orpah, as Orpah did, to just kind of say, okay, it's time for me to head back now. I understand, you know, you've got to go do the things. It would have been natural for her to go back to her own people. But this here we see this woman going beyond expectation. And so she is making this lifelong commitment. This lifelong commitment. And I think that the next verse is really very funny. When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. Ruth makes this
talk her out.
It's like, fine, if you're going to be that way. I got it. She says no more.
Shoulder, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, come on here. What? Because it's interesting. Before, let me see here. In verse, there's all this weeping and kissing. If you look at verse 9. Go to verse 9. The Lord, it says, the Lord grant that you may find security, each of you in the house of your husband. Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud. Okay, so that's the first try. She's trying to say, you need to go back, take care of yourself. And then you go down to verse 14. And she had just said, okay, enough. I can't have any more kids. There's not going to be enough time here. So go back. And then again, verse 14. Then they wept aloud, and Orpah kissed the daughters-in-law, and then Ruth clung to her. There's all this weeping and kissing. And then this time, it's like, well, fine. We're going. You know? It's, I guess, I don't know. So it goes, we'll go on here. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. Bethlehem being the community of food, the place of food. When they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred. Whenever you hear the whole town was stirred, or this idea of stirring, it means there were gossipers. This is what's going on here.
Correct.
Yeah? You know, I spent the last year in a small community. So I know a little bit about this, you know. If you want to find out what's going on, you go get your hair cut or you go to the grocery store, you know. So the whole town... Actually,
is that why you wear your hair so short?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I kept hearing things about me and I didn't like it. So I had my wife to shave my head. So I've used this study this summer, and someone sent me this little story. It's called The Church Gossip. Mildred, the church gossip and self-appointed arbiter of the church's morals, kept sticking her nose into other people's business. Several residents were unappreciative of her activities, but feared her enough to maintain their silence. You know what I'm talking about. There's people like this. She made a mistake, however, when she accused George, a new member, of being an alcoholic, after she saw his pickup truck parked in front of the town's only bar one afternoon. She commented to George and others that everyone seeing it there would know what he was doing. George, a man of few words, stared at her for a moment and then just walked away. He didn't explain, defend, or deny anything. He just said nothing. Later that evening, George quietly parked his pickup truck in front of Mildred's house.
Oh, a wise man.
Oh,
that's perfect.
It's so funny. You know, having spent time in a small town this last year, I'd forgotten what it was like. You know, I grew up in smaller communities. My dad was a small town rural pastor. But we were there for a week. And so we'd come there on a Sunday, and we kind of spent the week getting moved in, and then it was the following Sunday. And people came up to me, oh, welcome, welcome. One guy came up to us and said, and he'd never been in our house before. He said, it looks like you're really getting settled. I saw you have your bookshelf set up in your office all set up. I'm like, how the heck did he know? I'm just driving by, peering in the windows, seeing what we're doing. So life in a small town, I guess. I don't know.
Fishbowl.
Yes, fishbowl. So we're back to Bethlehem here. The whole town was stirring because of them. And the women's and the women, you know, at the maybe the beauty salon there, you know, is this Naomi? She said to them, "Can I have? Is there another lady that would read this little section here through the end of 21? Somebody be willing to read it? Okay.
Call me no longer Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi?"
There's more. Oh, keep going. I'm sorry.
"When the Lord has dealt harshly with me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me."
Yeah. It's interesting. At the beginning of this story, we have the Lord being the one who brings food, who's the provider. And now the Lord is the one who's bringing calamity here. And we talked yesterday a little bit about how in the midst of pain and difficult times in our lives, that is a natural response. You know, that we, you know, we go, okay, God, what's going on here?
Well, they believe that the Lord guided their lives coming and going pretty much, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, there is this sense that God is the provider of all. You know, whether it's the ups and or the downs. It's interesting here, kind of there's some more Hebrew here. So no longer call me sweetness, no longer call me pleasantness, if we look at verse 20 there, but call me bitterness. Mara in the Hebrew means bitterness. And so for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away with a family. We had things together. We set off to a land where we knew there would be food. We were caring for our family. But now the Lord has brought me back empty. I have nothing anymore without my husband, without my male children. I come back with nothing. And so I'm empty. And on top of that, I've got this lady who won't leave me alone. You know, she's my daughter-in-law, and doggone it, she's wonderful, but this is some baggage right now. I don't know. The Lord has brought me empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So Naomi returned together with Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, who came back with her from the country of Moab. You're going to have to give me just a second, because there was something I wanted to look up here. I don't want to do that. Let's go to Deuteronomy 23. I want you to get a sense of how this relationship between the Moabites and the Israelites, what that looked like. And so turn to Deuteronomy 23. Well, not the first one. That's not Ruth there. Yeah, for men, that's like the most painful verse in the entire Bible there. But let's skip down, how about it? Avoid the pain and go to verse 3. "No Ammonites or Moabites, shall be admitted to the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of their descendants shall be admitted to the assembly of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on your journey to Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. So we see here that there is this deep, deep anxiety, or this deep hatred, this deep division between the Israelites and the Moabites. And this is going to play out here with Ruth. We're going to notice as we go on through this story of Ruth, that Ruth is often called Ruth the Moabite, or just the Moabite. We return to that language time and time again, that she is the outsider. She's not the insider, she is the outsider. And you know what? People knew that. I mean, they would have seen that. This is a big deal that she's coming into this community. She would have been hated simply for who she was. And so let's turn back to Ruth again here. So down Ruth, let's see, verse 22. So Naomi returned together with Ruth the Moabite. Remember, Ruth the Moabite. Her daughter-in-law, who came back with her from the country of Moab. And, you know, it's interesting how people, they use literature. You know, this is just a beautifully constructed sentence. Ruth the Moabite. And not only that, she's from the country of Moab. Don't you forget this. They came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley festival, or barley harvest, where the story, this chapter began with famine. The first sentence says famine. It ends in harvest. We get this sense that God is the one that provides. God is the one who's provided this food for them. But we also are kind of given this sense that how is God going to work out this other issue? This issue of the family continuing, this issue of the family name. And so where God has provided for their food needs, now how is God going to provide for Ruth and or for Naomi and her family needs? And so we turn to chapter 2. Can we have someone be the narrator here? We're going to split this up into parts. Who would like to be the narrator? Anybody?
Okay.
Okay, we got a narrator. And we need someone to be Ruth the Moabite.
Okay.
Ruth the Moabite, okay. So you read the parts that Ruth would have spoke. And then we have Naomi. Who would be Naomi? We need a Naomi. Anybody? Come on. Don't be scared. There we go. Okay, good. And I think that is it. If there's anything else, I'll just chime in. So let's read the first 7 verses there of chapter 2.
Now Naomi had a kinsman on her husband's side, a prominent rich man of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi,
"Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain, behind someone in whose sight I might find favor."
She said to her,
"Go, my daughter."
So she went. She came and gleaned in the field beside the reapers. As it happened, she came to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Just then Boaz came from Bethlehem. He said to the reapers,
The Lord be with you.
They answered,
"The Lord bless you."
Then Boaz said to his servants, who was in charge of the reapers,
"To whom does this young woman belong?"
The servant who was in charge of the reapers answered,
"She is the Moabite who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab."
She said,
"Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the reapers."
So she came, and she has been on her feet from early this morning until now, without resting even for a moment.
So they get to Bethlehem, and there's this guy, Boaz. The name Boaz would have been another one of these little names that are indicators. And this name Boaz means in him is strength. So all of a sudden, on the scene comes this guy by the name of Boaz, who's got this name, in him is strength. And so it would have been this indicator, oh wow, you know, it's kind of like reading a really good novel. Yeah, what's the page turner, Brown, the Da Vinci Code? You know, I could see them sitting here going, oh my gosh, here's a clue, and wanting to turn the next page. You know, one of those books where you can't put it down. Okay, what's going to happen next? So, does anybody wonder about this Boaz guy? I mean, are there any questions that you think of when you heard of this guy coming on the scene? Up until this point, it doesn't seem they knew of any other family. You know, there's no indication that there's any family, other family, and all of a sudden they get to Bethlehem, and, oh, there's this Boaz guy that they're supposedly related to. A kinsman on her husband's side, a prominent rich man. So there's a different setup. He's a rich man, and they are destitute. This is one who might. It's like the door is opening just a little bit. Oh my, there might be some hope here. There just might be. So whose name was Boaz? His name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field." Notice here that Ruth is taking a role of power here. She's taking more authority, and we see a switch in the story where Ruth is taking an active role, and Naomi is really taking a passive role. Ruth is the one now who's going to be the actor in this story. And Naomi, in some sense, you know, after Ruth kind of spills her guts here, Naomi says no more. And we really have Naomi turning into this one who is now in mourning. You know, she's really kind of taking a backseat. What can I do? There's nothing I can do. And kind of taking this passive role. And so Ruth comes in and says, "Let me go to the field. I'm going." It's more of a statement of intent. I'm going to do this and glean among the ears of grain. This idea of gleaning would be similar to kind of the social safety nets that we have set up today. You know, it would have been like going to the food bank, you could say, or going to...
That's a lot harder work.
Yeah, it's a lot harder work. But it would have been set up in society that it was like a social safety net in some ways. That this is the way that we care for people who are in need. And so there was this, it was just a regular accepted practice that you follow along behind the workers in the field. And whatever they miss or whatever falls along the side, that would be what you can glean. And so you could take that for your own. And so this is, in some ways, it is a safety net that was set up. Back in Deuteronomy, we have some laws set up about how this exactly works, how this looks. And so this gleaning is a social service in some way, you could say.
Weren't they supposed to not glean our harvest all the way to the edge of the field?
Right.
The ditches or something were supposed to not touch?
Yep. There was that little edge on the side of the field. And then anything that as they went through it would fall, you know, that would be fair game for the gleaners. Good. And so go on, and here again, in the end of verse 2, we have Naomi taking this passive role. Go, my daughter, just go, do what you think is right. So she went, she came, and she gleaned in the field behind the reapers. And then, this is kind of funny. You have to kind of read scripture with a little bit of humor. Mm-hmm. As it happened, well, it's like saying, by chance, it just so happened that she came to the part of the field belonging to this guy, Boaz, and it just so happened that Boaz was of the family of Elimelech. What a coincidence here, huh? What a coincidence. I think as we read this story, we find out that these coincidences are not just coincidence, but they're the acts of a hidden God at work in this story. The acts of a God who provides, who starts by providing food, but now will be working behind the scenes to provide for the family, the deep needs of the family, and the longevity of the family. So it just so happened that there was this Boaz guy who just so happened to be a member of the family. Just then Boaz came to Bethlehem. He saw, he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." So it's just a blessing, a greeting. Then in verse 5, then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "To whom does this young woman belong?" We hear here again kind of the patriarchal society, of the patriarchalness of society. It's not who is this woman, it's not what is her name, it's not, you know, even where did she come from, but it's who does this woman belong to? Ruth doesn't fit any classifications as to what an answer for that would have, what a normal answer would have been. Ruth was a Moabite, an outsider. So she didn't belong necessarily to anyone local. Her husband had died, so she did not have, she was no longer, you wouldn't say, well, she is of the family of Elimelech, because she, her husband had passed on. And so she didn't fit any of the normal answers. And so the reaper answer, or the head reaper, the one who was in charge, said, "She is a Moabite who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. Again, the double Moab reference there. She's an outsider. She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the reapers." So she came, and she has been on her feet from early this morning until now, without resting for even a moment. This woman, this outsider, is given worth here. She is a hard worker. Something about her has been seen already. Okay, so she's from another country, from another land, but she is a hard worker. There's something about her that's different. And so we go on in verse 8, and I'll read there. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young men."
Women.
Or young women. Yeah, stay away from the men. To the young women, stay close. It's interesting the language here that's used. Keep close. If you go back to verse 14 of the first chapter. Then they wept aloud again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. It's the same word there, that clung to her, as Ruth is clinging to Naomi. So also now, she's being instructed, Ruth is being instructed to cling to the other women, to stay close to them. This is this clinging has something to do with security. Mm-hmm. It's all about security. And so Orpah left, but Ruth clung. And now Boaz is instructing them to cling to the other young women. This clinging is all about their security. So it goes on in verse 9, "Keep your eyes on the field that is being reaped and follow behind them. I have ordered the young men not to bother you." The Jewish Bible translates bother as molest. I mean, so this is kind of gives us a flavor of what this society would have been like. You've got a woman who does not have a man in her life. You've got a woman who is all alone. And what kind of...
she'd be fair game.
Yeah, she would have been, well put, she would have been fair game.
Because she had less than no status being a Moabite.
Yeah. She had no home, really. And so that would have been a good translation of that. The young man not to molest her, or to take advantage of her. So it goes on, if you get thirsty, though, go to the vessel and drink from the water the young men have drawn. Well, this is kind of strange. Why does she get this special privilege? There's a special privilege. Then she fell prostrate with her face to the ground and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me when I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your daughter-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. May the Lord reward you for your deeds, and may you have a full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." Then she said, "May I continue to find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have confronted me and spoken kindly to your servant, even though I am not one of your servants." Here again, we have reference to this idea of hesed, this idea of loyalty. Ruth, the one that has no worth, is given value in this scripture here, in this passage that we just read, by her loyalty. Her loyalty is what is giving her status here. But Boaz, in verse 11, Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me." All that you have done, it's a little different word there in the Hebrew, but it is all the hesed you have done, all the things that you have done out of loyalty for your family, are now giving you worth and value beyond what people see on the outside.
What I don't understand is he supposedly didn't know her, but all of a sudden he sure knows an awful lot about her.
I haven't seen her picture.
It's the gossip.
Yeah, I think it has to do with these gossipers, you know.
Got a haircut the day before.
When you got a haircut. I'm trying to look back here. If we go back to chapter two, verse somewhere in here, I think I remember it saying he had heard of their situation or something like that. But yeah, it is referenced to the talk of the town. You know, the buzz is out that this woman, Naomi, who had gone away full, has now come back, and she's in shambles.
But her daughter-in-law had taken good care of her.
Well, yeah.
And obviously, they had to travel a pretty good distance, and that was something in itself. So.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to think about the age here. The life expectancy of a woman at this time would have been about 40 years old. And so one of the commentaries said that she was probably, Naomi was probably about 35 years old at the time. And so what that journey back was like, it certainly was dusty. It certainly was not an easy journey.
Ruth would have been about 26.
Well,
she'd been married 10 years, and if you think of her getting married at 14 to 16.
You know, between 12 and 15, 14. Yeah, so she would have been probably about 22, 24, somewhere in there. And so that's why, you know, we're cued into the fact that most likely Ruth is a woman who is barren, you know, because it would have been most likely that when she first was married, it would have been natural to have children. I mean, that was seen as the woman's role. And so it's most likely that she was a barren woman, because now she's at this later age. You know, at 22, she's at middle age already.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, back to kind of where we were at here, verse 11 and 12. Ruth is given status here by her loyalty. She is worthy of more than she is seen by the community. She's given worth. And so verse 12, "May the Lord reward you for your deeds, and may you have full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." The word wings is also one of these Hebrew words that's going to kind of point us forward a little bit. The word is also the same word used for cloak or cloth or the kind of the covering you would have worn. And we know kind of the story is going towards a scene where a cloak or a covering becomes important. So you have found refuge under the wing of God. So it goes on. Then she said, "May I continue to find favor in your sight, my lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, even though I am not one of your servants." Can we have someone, would someone be willing to read 14 through 16? Somebody read that? Yeah,
okay.
Go ahead.
"At mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come here and eat some of this bread and dip your morsel in the sour wine.' So she sat beside the reapers, and he heaped up for her some parched grain. She ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she got up to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, 'Let her glean even among the standing sheaves, and do not reproach her. You must also pull out some handfuls for her from the bundles, and leave them for her to glean, and do not rebuke her.'"
What? What do you make of all this special attention she's getting from Boaz? What's your kind of reaction to that? What do you think's going on here?
I think he liked her.
I think he also felt a family loyalty and was glad that they were willing to work for it and weren't coming for him to beg him for help with no contribution of their own. She was willing to work for what she was doing, so he'd give her a little ease, and it would provide for Naomi his camp.
So the family connection, there's something about that.
But I think he liked her. She's probably pretty good with him.
I think it says something about Boaz's personality, even as it's said up above here about the fact that she was to keep with the young women for her protection. Mm-hmm. But then she could drink water from where his men were getting it. So I see him as a manager, a boss, who picked wisely those whom he hired.
And had good control.
And he expected them to follow his directions here when he told them to kind of look after her, take care of her, and give her extra. So it tells us something about his personality, his authority, his ability to judge people who would work for him. So he also had an ability to judge
And there's something, you know, you think about his name, and him is strength. Mm-hmm. You almost get this sense that he is one who's watching out for people, for people that are down and out. I almost wonder, is this very unusual for Boaz, that he would help out someone in this special way? Might there have been others? Well, certainly there's the family connection, and we can't deny that. But you get this sense that he is one who is caring. He's a caring man. He's watching out for those that are destitute, those that are hard off. You said that he most likely liked her. There's something about her. The last time I did a study on this, the ladies had this. They had picked out the actors they would use in the story. You know, who would be who. You know, and they picked, I don't even remember, but they picked these, you know, maybe, you know, Tom Hanks or someone, maybe Boaz, this kind of bright man, and, you know, who are some of the beautiful actresses today? I don't know, maybe Julia Roberts or something like that would play Ruth, or Catherine Zeta-Jones or something like that. But you get this, there is this little hint of attraction here. You know, there is this little kind of playful hint of something more than just familial relationships. So at mealtime, we're back to the mealtime, verse 14. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some of the bread and dip the morsel in the sour wine." So she sat beside the reapers, sat beside the people that were paid to do this work, sat beside the people that were worthy of this work.
And men,
given a place. She was given a place of honor in some ways. Her status was raised here. I love this next verse. So she sat beside the reapers, and he heaped up on her some parched grain. I imagine with this big spoon. Jeez, I'm giving her more food, you know? Back in Minnesota, there's a commercial about air conditioners. And the guy comes and says to his buddy, you know, it's our anniversary, and what'd you get your wife for your anniversary? did you get her gold or diamonds or something like that? No, no, I got her an air conditioner, a train air conditioner, you know. I see this guy trying to impress this woman with big heaps of food on her plate. And so she ate until she was satisfied, and there was more food left over. There was food left over. You know, you have this contrast from the beginning of the story where there was just not enough. There was no food. To now this situation where God is working behind the scenes to provide, and to provide in excess. And you think about Naomi's loyalty being a loyalty of excess. You think of Boaz being this one who's reached out to Ruth now in excess, and one who's providing more than enough. And God kind of at work behind the scenes, heaping up for her these wonderful gifts. So she ate until she was satisfied, and she had left some that was left over. When she got up to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, again, going above and beyond the call to duty, let them glean even among the standing sheaves. Let them take even the first fruits of your harvest. Let them take the very best, and do not reproach her for it. Let her pick up the best. You must also pull out, he's saying here, you must also pull out some handfuls for her from the bundles, and leave them for her to glean, and do not rebuke her. Let her take from the best, from what is the good grain, not just the stuff on the edge, not just the stuff that's been trampled, but take the best. What time are we? Oh, it's 10 already. My gosh. That's fine. Well, how about this? We'll just read through the end of this chapter. So she gleaned in the field until evening. She beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah, or two-thirds of a bushel of barley. She picked it up and came into the town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gleaned. Could you imagine? I mean, she had sent her out in the morning with little or no prospect, going, okay, whatever, just go try. And here she comes back with, 5 to 7 days worth of food. Then she took out and gave her what was left over after she herself had been satisfied. Her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she took her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the name of the man with whom I worked today is Boaz, the man in whom we shall find strength. Then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, blessed be he by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi also said to her, the man is a relative of ours, one of our nearest kin. Then Ruth the Moabite said, he even said to me, stay close, cling to my servants until they have finished all my harvest. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is better, my daughter, that you go out with his young women. Otherwise, you might be bothered in another field. So she stayed close. She clung to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest, and she lived with her mother-in-law. This is a great story of a God who provides, a God who works behind the scenes and provides in excess. Good. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
We don't get here.